Thank you for your attendance today. I appreciate you braving the storm, the snow. So my talk today will be, let's see. Okay, first I want to say I have no financial disclosures, financial relationships to disclose, and that I would like to thank my sponsors, the National Institute of Hometown Security, for sponsoring this research. My talk today will be about a study that we've just wrapped up that included a mixed methods approach to understanding H1N1 mitigation efforts. And this approach included focus groups, cognitive interviews, electronic surveys, and a variety of different measures that included professionals in both public health, behavioral health, healthcare, legal ethics, and families and children who were impacted by H1N1. And then in addition, we did a comprehensive review of all 50 state pandemic flu preparedness plans. Our final sample size included over 1,800 experts and 755 families, so pretty comprehensive review. And we collected data in six of the most heavily hit states, including California, Texas, New York, Arizona, Florida, and Kentucky, and then we were also in Mexico and in Canada. Okay, the purpose of our study was to identify best practices and lessons learned from different communities' efforts to mitigate pandemic flu. And specifically, we're interested in how those efforts impacted the mental health and the quality of well-being of children and their families. And then, as you'll see at the end of our study, our result was to propose a family-focused, boundary-spanning position. Okay. To refresh your memory from last year, H1N1 began in the early spring in Mexico City, Mexico, and then quickly spread throughout California into Texas, and then throughout. And by June, the World Health Organization had declared H1N1 a pandemic. Okay. The initial episodes of H1N1 in Mexico City were pretty severe, and a disproportionate number of deaths occurred. So the resulting mitigation efforts were pretty strong at first, and they included social distancing, school closure, some suggested travel restrictions, and for healthcare workers, they were recommending that universal health care, universal precautions be taken, including N95 masks for all first responders and healthcare workers. And then, as you'll remember, there was round-the-clock news coverage of the event, which obviously contributed to some of the anxieties surrounding H1N1. In the beginning stages of our pandemic, vaccines were not available. And then when they were eventually rolled out towards October, November, December of last year, they were distributed in a prioritized mechanism where certain groups were given priority and others were not. For instance, young children and pregnant women were prioritized, but the elderly were excluded. And then later, as vaccine supplies became more abundant, the distribution included all groups, and this led to some confusion about the vaccine itself. Okay. And in our experience with interviewing across the different locations, we found that nearly all officials confirmed at least some use of quarantining of people who were exposed to H1N1, and then isolation, particularly hospital-based isolation, of sick patients. And the epidemiological data that resulted from the survey did confirm that the elderly were not as at risk of consequences, and that the children and young adults were much more likely to be infected by the disease and also more likely to require hospitalization. The resulting consequences of the change in mitigation strategies resulted in some mistrust of public health, the public health response, some misunderstanding of the recommendations, and a degree of noncompliance with social distancing and vaccine recommendations. For instance, we found in some communities, there would be sporadic school closures where one school with cases might close, another school with other cases wouldn't close. And then so you had parents that would hold their kids back, forcing school closure, and it was just a very non-coordinated effort in certain areas. And then there was also some concern about the vaccine safety, particularly in the vaccinations of young children. And so you saw a rejection of vaccine that could have helped. We found that children were both the vector and the victim of this pandemic. In typical seasonal flu, children are usually the vector, but it's most often the elderly that suffer the most consequences. Whereas here, we found that children were both vector and victim. In fact, pediatric deaths from the flu were about four times what the annual rate was deaths. And by November of last year, there had been an estimated 500 children who died. And then we also found that children were the highest hospitalized group. For those who were quarantined and isolated, we found some results that were unexpected. We found that the rates of post-traumatic stress and other types of psychological consequences, anxiety, were much higher than we had predicted. We found that the rates of PTSD-like symptoms in persons who were quarantined or isolated were similar to those that you would see following a natural disaster like a hurricane or a flood. And we also found evidence throughout that healthcare workers, the parents of people who patients who were quarantined or isolated, and the patient themselves felt some sort of stigma towards having been infected, which confounded the anxiety and stress that they experienced. Okay. In our review of the state plans, we found that there was very little emphasis on protecting the mental health and mental well-being of children, specifically in the state plans. There was a lot of mention about conducting a family-focused response, but the actual preparedness efforts for meeting child mental health needs was pretty lacking. And so despite identified need, the family-focused response, particularly from a mental health perspective, was not really planned for or very well implemented. So as a result of our analysis and our interviews, we proposed the creation of a new position called a boundary spanner. And a boundary spanner, you can see from this diagram, a boundary spanner is a person who or agency who we propose that would reside in the state health department or state emergency management system who would have specific training in child behavioral health and also be well connected to different stakeholders relevant to child health. These people might include the education system, the legal and ethics system, families and children's health care, behavioral health, and et cetera. And what we would see, what we propose is that this boundary spanner would serve to provide resources to local health departments so that they can better implement a family-focused, child-focused pandemic response. And we propose specific recommendations in this talk. I'm talking about mental health recommendations, but the boundary spanner would facilitate these recommendations at each health department, and I'll talk about nine of them briefly. So the first one is that based on our findings of the psychological distress of quarantining or isolation, we think that people who are quarantined or isolated should be evaluated and monitored for PTSD, and their family members should automatically be assessed as well. And that most likely the people who will be in the best position to do this screening will be pediatricians and other primary care physicians. So we need to provide these resources with the screening tools necessary to assess mental health. during the screening, particularly of children who have been quarantined, we want the provider to pay attention to feelings of isolation, loneliness, and social disconnectedness that the children might encounter, and focus on in parents understanding their anxiety related to the separation from their family, and then also that they understand why they're being quarantined or isolated. And then we also suggest that the screening be linked to services provided in the community, and that in order to maintain some of the social distancing, some of the intervention processes should include things like alternative means of therapy. For instance, we saw in Miami at a hospital where they used Skype and web cameras to help keep families connected that were isolated. We thought that was really good. So screening should happen. People who are detected should be referred to service, and then service should include alternative mechanisms. Okay. The boundary spanner we propose will provide to local departments, health departments, the psychoeducational materials that they need to help build resiliency in their community. So these materials will include things like understanding how to keep yourself healthy, both physically and mentally, and then also what are the different community resources that are available to you. And the purpose of this would be to decrease the uncertainty about the response to the disease, and also increase self-efficacy, their own belief self-efficacy. We also propose that the boundary spanner help integrate behavioral and medical health care. And so that would require that they link behavioral services to medical services and work as a conduit between those two groups. And then, because we recognize that mental health stress is going to be quite a burden on the healthcare system and the psychological system, we propose that they capitalize on existing informal therapeutic relationships like churches and other religious organizations, and that the boundary spanner would be used to provide common resources, psychoeducational materials, whatnot, for these informal therapeutic relationships. And then lastly, we propose that the preparedness communication should focus on not just how to keep yourself physically healthy, but how to mitigate the stress of response efforts such as social distancing, including quarantining and isolation. And finally, in all of these recommendations, we say that local health departments should rely on the boundary spanner. So in conclusion, our efforts indicated that there were several unintended consequences that resulted from community mitigation efforts. And children, unfortunately, bore much of the brunt of those. And the psychological consequences are just now starting to be recognized from our efforts. And we think that some of these consequences stem predictably from not having a really family-focused, child-focused preparedness planning effort, and we propose that a boundary spanner who's specifically trained in child health and child mental welfare can help develop a family-focused response. Okay. These recommendations are based on empiric study and observation, and part of our research efforts right now are to shop these recommendations, particularly the idea of a boundary spanner, around to other public health officials and persons like yourself, and see if we can generate some feedback. And to facilitate that, at the back table, I've put some slips where you can participate in a brief survey, an electronic survey, if you'd like to provide feedback and help us. Otherwise, I'd be happy to take your comments, either email or here in person. Thank you.
And we do have time for a couple of questions for Dr. LaJoy. Thanks.
Yeah. In regard to the results that there was an objection to the vaccination because of what had happened, how do you see that playing
I think that's a really good question. One of the surprising things that we saw last year was that there was actually an increase in the number of people who were taking seasonal flu, and which is good since now this year the seasonal flu is actually combined with H1N1 vaccine. So, and since there were few adverse events that resulted from the vaccine, we hope to see a continued uptake of the seasonal flu vaccine this year. Thanks. Yeah?
Looking at the experiences of kids that were in quarantine or isolated, the PTSD kind of disconcerting to me, is that comparable, or have we looked at other experiences with quarantine for other infectious diseases? Was it the quarantine that was the problem, or was it the panic around the pandemic?
I think that's a great question, Sarah. Because of the heightened anxiety that sort of surrounded H1N1, you know, you had H1N1 coming on the heels of SARS and worries about bird flu, and there was a lot of pent-up anxiety that surrounded it. And then so when kids and or their family members were quarantined or isolated, and there was a lot of uncertainty with regards to the actual mechanism of disease, I think that coupled to add to the PTSD risk factor. And whether or not those PTSD symptoms are prolonged, it's yet to be known. Thanks. Thank you very much, I appreciate it.